Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Jinshan, now he was one of the old masters in China shortly after Bodhidharma. Jensha complained to his followers one day, "Other masters are always carrying on about the necessity of saving everyone. But suppose you meet up with someone who is deaf, dumb, and blind. He couldn't see your gestures, hear your preaching, or for that matter, ask a question. Unable to save him, you'd prove yourself a worthless Zenist or Buddhist." Now, troubled by these words, one of Jensha's disciples went to consult the master Uman, who, like Jensha, was a disciple of Seppo. And he went in there to talk to this master, and the master looked at him. He said, "Bow, please." You know, and the monk, he was taken by surprise. He obeyed the command, and then he straightened up in expectation of having his query answered. You know, but instead of an answer, he got a staff thrust in his face, and so he leaped back. You know, "Well," said Uman, "you aren't blind. So now approach." And so the monk did as he was bidden. He came up a little closer. "Good," said Uman, "you're not deaf either. Well, understand?" "Understand what, sir?" "Ah, then you're not dumb either," said Uman. And on hearing these words, the monk awoke as from a deep sleep. Yeah. Of late, it seems to me that we've been hearing a lot about the Dalai Lama. He's been in the news. He's been on the television. Some of you have given me little pieces out of the newspaper, you know, where he's been interviewed and so on. And questions are asked of him about his religion. He is, after all, the religious head of Tibet. And this Dalai Lama, he very often says, you know, as a good Buddhist, you do good, you know, you help others. See, and this is what he tells reporters that Buddhism is that we help each other. And as the precept goes, not to commit evil, but to do all that is good and to keep one's thoughts pure. And that is the teaching of the seven Buddhas. Yeah? So, and in the mantras, you know, that are recited the world over in Buddhism and in Zen, you know, this however innumerable beings are, I vow to save them. However inexhaustible the passions are, I vow to extinguish them. However immeasurable the dharmas are, I vow to master them. However incomparable the Buddha truth is, I vow to attain it. We chant it. And out of this, naturally, Zen being what it is, there comes a koan. You know, that there's this monk that's living in a little hut far away from everybody. It's one little room, and he never leaves there. And every day he's repeating these vows. And yet he saved innumerable beings without talking to anyone and without leaving the place. How did he do this? Yeah. Nice. Nicely done. We see. And we hear. And we speak. And this world, as it appears, seemingly surrounds us. And it has color and it has sounds. And we think and we talk about the world that we perceive with ears and eyes. Yeah. However, now, in looking at the world and looking at each other and looking at yourselves, you know, Jesus said several times in the Gospels, perceive ye not, neither understand, have ye your heart yet hardened? Having eyes, see ye not, and having ears, hear ye not? And do ye not remember? How is it that ye do not understand? And the disciples to whom he was speaking, you know, they had ears just like us, and they had eyes just like us. So Jesus must have meant something else, something different. Maybe there is a different way of seeing. Maybe there is a different way of hearing. Maybe there is a different way of being. And when that different perception is present, then God is seen and God is heard, for God speaks. Until then, deaf to God, dumb to God, and blind to God. We say, oh, no, you know, I talk to God. God is familiar. In your thoughts? What about the real God? Not a thinking, not a thought that you have thunked. What about the reality of God that you don't think, that is presented to you? Francis Bacon, at one time he wrote, nay, the same Solomon the king, although he excelled in the glory of treasure and magnificent buildings, of shipping and navigation, of service and attendance, of fame and renown, and the like, you know, yet he maketh no claim to any of these glories, but only to the glory of the inquisition of truth. For he saith expressly, the glory of God is to conceal a thing, but the glory of the king is to find it out. As if, according to the innocent play of children, the divine majesty took delight to hide his works, to the end to have them found out, and as if kings could not obtain a greater honor than to be God's playfellows in that game, to find him out, to become a king. His playfellow, huh? And Shakespeare, you know, he said, and take upon us the mystery of things as if we were God's spies. Yeah. This little phrase, you know, that Francis Bacon used, this inquisition of truth, you know, this severe questioning, this investigation that is conducted within oneself with no regard of one's own idiosyncrasies, to become a spy of oneself, you know, to penetrate this mystery of God. When we look around, you know, if one travels sometimes, you know, and you go from city to city and you see people and you look around, and in this society, in the daily life of people, you know, God is not a necessity. He's a luxury. Social laws, scientific laws, they're necessary, because there must be a common rudder to steer society. And of course, science has its laws by which it directs itself. And all of this can take place without a thought of God. You can exist without a thought of God. It's a kind of a vegetable existence, maybe, but you know, you don't need it unless you need it. You know? Without God, our being doesn't have much meaning. You know, we're all tied up in our becomings. We're becoming happy, we're becoming sad, we're becoming better educated, we're becoming moneyed, we're becoming whatever, huh? Yeah. We're tied up in this, in our becomings. So then life kind of becomes like arithmetic. 2 comes after 1, and 1 comes after 0, and 5 comes after 4. You know, it's like you're running a business. Yeah. But there is not any of this awesome mystery in it, you know. Nor can you have, in that kind of an arrangement, have a love affair with him. It's just kind of a blahness in the heart, because you're missing something. For some people, he is a necessity. And when a man like Jesus speaks, you know, having ears, hear ye not, you know, something tremendously great is speaking through him. And when a man like Buddha speaks, something which is not of time and not of space penetrates into time and space. They bring something from what in Zen is called the other shore, from the shore of wisdom to this shore of ignorance. And it may just be like a little breeze whispering of what is, if only the ears could hear. Only the ears could hear. The man Muhammad, you know, he had been a teacher and he'd been preaching around and about. And then suddenly, one day, abruptly, there was this contact. It's rather like Saul on the way to Damascus. Suddenly, there was this contact with the divine. And he fell to the ground. And he started shivering. And he started shaking. And he couldn't speak. And somehow, he got home, and he went to bed. And his wife was quite beside herself, you know. She put all these blankets around him, and still he shivered and shook. And she kept asking him questions, you know. What happened? Why don't you speak? Why don't you answer me? What happened? You have become so silent. And it's reported that finally when he did come around to talking, he said, "For the first time, I have got something to say." For 3 days, he was in bed, absolutely silent. And then, just as a small child begins to talk, he started. And that's how the Quran was written. Yeah. He had something to say. Finally. All the talking that we do, all the blah blahing, talk. Do you ever pay attention to what comes out of your mouth? Pay a lot of attention to what somebody else may say to you. I mean, how you react to that. But what about what comes out of your mouth? Do you ever hear what you're saying? Our little monk, you know, we talk about a little monk because we can dump all kinds of things on him and he doesn't mind. No. And he went to another village one day and he was staying with his family for a while. And one evening, you know, the mother was busy in the kitchen and the monk sat with the father in quiet conversation. And the little boy comes in. And he asks his father if he would answer a few questions for him. The father says, "Well, I'm busy right now. Go and ask your mother." To which the child said, "I don't want to know that much." There's no end to her talking. "I don't want to know that much." Yeah. So it would seem almost as if we have a great investment in our talking. You know? Millions of people in this state of being deaf and dumb and blind. There must be some investment in it. You know, it must be paying something. It must be doing something for them. But what? I want to know what. Why is it so important that they can't set it aside and look differently? They must be getting something out of it. How is it possible that the Buddhas and the patriarchs and Christ and the seers in India, you know, they keep on saying, they have been saying, they did say, don't be blind, don't be deaf, don't be dumb, be alert, be alive. Come awake! And nobody seems to hear. To understand Zen is a very simple way of coming alive. It is also very difficult to grasp. It's too simple. Yeah. Zen just feels fire warm and ice cold. When it's freezing, we shiver, and then we welcome the fire. But this feeling of feeling cold and feeling warm, must be understood in its deepest sense. Or we could say in its purest form. If you're standing by the fire and say, "This is the feeling I have," Zen is no more present. It's already an abstraction. You understand abstractions? You do? Isn't that nice? Then I don't have to go through that anymore. In the Zen, One understands the phrase, there cannot be two masters in one house. Now, Kyozai, there was a teacher in China, and a monk said to him, I am pecking on the inside of the shell. It has long been depicted that the chick inside of the shell, you know, is picking away, trying to get out and become a chicken. And this little monk says, I am pecking on the inside of the shell. I ask you, he says to this teacher, to peck on the outside. And Kyozai says, well, are you in a state of active readiness or not? And the monk said, if I were not, people would despise me. And Kyozai said, you are still wallowing in the grass. Now, do you know out of that little story where this monk made his mistake? You want me to repeat the story? The monk says to Kyozai, I am pecking on the inside of the shell, and I ask you to peck on the outside. And Kyozai said, are you in a state of active readiness or not? And the monk says, if I were not, people would despise me. And Kyozai says, you're not even near ready. You're still wallowing in the grass. Yeah. This little chick pecking on the inside, and the mother hen is on the outside, so that the little chicken should be born, is a very apt symbol of a teacher and student. The student pecks on the inside, and the teacher pecks on the outside. You know. Why was this little monk so far from reaching the summit? He was still at the grain of grass at the foot of the mountain. Why? Zen is very perplexing. On the one hand, it seems to be very abrupt and almost cruel, you know. And on the other hand, is this compassion, and all this quiet sitting, careful, quiet sitting for meditation. And we've read these stories about the monks in China and Japan a long time ago. They live in a small hut, or they have a small temple, and they sustain themselves on rice and pickles, and don't ever for 1 minute think that their pickles are like our pickles, because they're not. And people think of them that they're simply a recluse, you know, that are fleeing from the world. You know, we all of us have this little bit of something, some more than others, but a little bit of something which tends to become a recluse. Sometimes we would like to be, you know, nobody around, just us, so that we can contemplate ourselves in the world. There is this, huh? Yeah. And then, of course, Zen does teach about non-attachment. So this is a nice way to become non-attached. You don't have anybody around you, so that to become attached to, and the world goes by, and there you are, living in your nice state of non-attachment, and you're still in the grass, wallowing at the foot of the mountain. Yeah. See, if one thinks that in Zen, this fleeing to live a nice, quiet life, if this is what you think Zen is, why then you have a very superficial view of it. Zen insights go very deep into the source of life. See? Because Zen itself is in touch with reality. The individual is supposed to take hold of this reality, the reality of himself, and never mind what people say. Huh? The reality of himself, and live it, you know, to live reality. Then, when I walk, I walk, and when I eat, I eat. Then that phrase makes sense. And it's not just some lollygagging around and say, I'm walking in awareness, you know. And there are people in other traditions around the world that question Zen, and they wonder about it. And they wonder about this word reality, because it doesn't sound devotional enough, you know. Reality, it's a nice concept. Yeah. And these terms, suchness and thusness and emptiness and void, you know, why, it's all nihilistic. If when we reach where we're going, there's not going to be anything, not even me. Why should I want to go, you know? They're dealing with concepts. Those who know Zen know that these terms are conceptual, that there is something very real and very direct and very vital in reality, not in the word. This reality, you know, which you are, is to be taken hold of in the midst of the living facts of this universe and not abstracted by means of thought. Zen never leaves this world of fact. The student does not stand apart from a world of names and form, from the nama-rupa, As long as we view this world, whether you view it religiously or philosophically or poetically, as long as it is object, it remains a threat because it stands as opposed to us, and there is no Zen present. Now, we often talk about you have to show in gesture what you understand. But these old masters, you know, they also used words. And in a dialogue, master with a monk, it's called a, the question and answer is called a mundo, So the in this case, why the student is asking the questions. Well, usually it's the other way around. And this student says, you know, what is the eye of the true Dharma? Everywhere. Then he comes with another question. When one commits patricide or matricide, one goes to the Buddha to confess the sin. However, if one murders a Buddha or a patriarch, where should one go for confession? Exposed. What is the Tao, meaning path or way, you know, or truth? What is the Tao? Walk on! How is it that without the parent's consent, one cannot be ordained? How shallow. I cannot understand. How deep. What kind of a phrase is it that does not cast any shadow? What does not cast any shadow? Revealed. How do you have an I in a question? I, E-Y-E, I in a question. Blind. That neat? That's a neat mundo boy. See? One simple little word explains the whole thing. Not words and words and words and words and words. Just revealed. Blind. Now, Uman, and he died in the year 949, and nobody knows how old he was at the time. But he had a dialogue with a monk, who again, the monk is asking Uman, what is the pure body of the Dharma? And Uman replied, the hedgerow. There's a bunch of shrubs, you know, that make a hedge. Hedgerow. Well, what is the behavior of one then who thus understands? And Uman said to him, he is a golden-haired lion. What about a golden-haired lion? What about it, A lion is a lion. He's supreme. He's the king of the beasts. He is complete as he is. He's not trying to be a horse or a cow or a pig. He is trying to be nothing. He is what he is. He's a lion. Yeah? Are you as human being complete? See, realize this completeness, this totality of yourself. See? And then this monk says, well, I understand that when a lion seizes upon his opponent, he makes an exhaustive use of his power. Pray tell me what this power is. And Uman said one word, which is translated as the spirit of sincerity. Or we could say the power of not deceiving. You know, and the story is told about the master who every morning when he got up, he called himself, answering, yes, 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 master. And he'd call himself again, he'd say, yes, master. And he'd call himself again, and he'd say, yes, master, do not deceive yourself. Do not deceive yourself. Sincerity, not deceiving, putting forth one's whole, complete being. You know, that is, it's complete in action. Nothing is kept in reserve. Nothing is disguised. Nothing is going to waste. When an individual lives like this, he is said to be a golden-haired lion because he is a symbol of sincerity. He is total sincerity. He's wholeheartedness because he is reality itself. He is the very thing, a human being complete. He is the truth, see, living among us. How do you recognize such a one? They have come and gone. People don't know them. How can they? Deaf, dumb, and blind. Yeah? And we meet a many who are in this state of deaf, dumb, and blind. And if you talk to them, they can't understand. Recognize it. They can't understand. All they can do is misunderstand. Because meaning is not given in words. Words communicate ideas. The idea is not the thing in itself. It is a step away from reality. Meaning is supplied by the listener. If I say something, I'm up here babbling away, you know, maybe I'm saying something, maybe I'm not. That's up to you. If I say something to maybe 100 people, there will be maybe 100 meanings because each individual will be listening from his or her state of consciousness. It's the same when you read a book. You read it from your state of consciousness. You know, you're listening from your mind, your conditioned mind, from your prejudice, from your conditioning. So our conditioning, everything that we have learned, our conditioning is our past. Huh? It is our conditioning that supplies for us meaning, generally speaking. And isn't that a shame? Huh? Unless one is listening without interference, without getting in the way, then maybe the word or the words will bring about a sudden insight. You know, it's all of a sudden something strikes. You know, it's like the sound of a door slamming, like the sound of a tile, you know, bamboo hitting a tile. It's like a bell in the silence, and something rises. So, and Rinzai had his kwats, and Obaku had his kwan. You know, it didn't mean anything, but they were sounds, you know, to, now here. Now, to create a situation for the student, you know, the pecking on the outside, to create the situation for the student to realize, you know, pecking. That's what a teacher does, yeah? And occasionally, something strikes, huh? And it's almost then as if someone opened a door and the light filters in. The light that filters in, we would say, is a gift from the sun. No one can create light by opening a door. Opening the door is not the cause of light. A closed door is a barrier. And we close doors more often than we realize. Oh, well, she said that before. Yeah, I understand what she means. And so you shuffle it off. And there's a barrier. You've got a closed door. You're still in abstractions, squirrel caging around, and reality has not risen to your view. Your subjective view, huh? The light has not entered. See? Light comes when it comes. That's true. Our effort is to remain with the open door so it can enter. When it does, it is always a gift. We call it grace. It has to be so. If you could attain to the ultimate through your efforts and your efforts alone, it would be absurd. It is then as if you could create the sky, which you can't. See, it's like this saying that this limited mind is going to create an unlimited mind. With thoughts? The use of the mind itself is limiting. How then are you going to create an unlimited? So this is this ignorant mind-making effort, huh? And the very efforts we make are in ignorance. Can this ignorance, you know, these thoughts, change and transform something in us into enlightenment? No. But you must make the effort. You make the effort. That's necessary, and the effort is to keep that door open. You know, it prepares you, and the happening happens when it happens, all of its own accord. It knows things, it knows better than you will ever know. Yeah? You just remain available. The light will penetrate. After all, the sun rises every day. Now the Buddha said, when you attain, you help others. When you attain, you start helping others. Because now the energy that was moving in the desire and our desires are innumerable. Huh? They are much more so in number than this ignorant mind even suspects. Our energies are held by desires. And when one attains, they become compassion. Then how to help another attain to this ultimate? You know, so first you let the light in, holding the door open for yourself. How are you going to help someone else when you can't even find the doorknob? Or even the keyhole? Ever find the keyhole to get in? Yeah. So this monk, he's very puzzled by these words of Jensha's. You know, how can you help someone who is deaf, dumb, and blind? See, Uman, Kyosai, and Jensha were all students of Seppo. Tremendous man. Mm-hmm. If you're blind, I can't show you the door because you can't see. I can't tell you about the door because you can't listen. You can't hear. You can't even ask, where is the door, if you're dumb. So Seppo, he was a very silent man. He would sit and do nothing, except maybe once in a while create a situation. Yeah. If you wanted to learn, you could be with him. If you didn't want to, you could go. It didn't make any difference. But you had to learn. He already knew. You had to learn. See? Always he threw everything back on your shoulders, where it rightfully belongs. You know, I'm not around here to get your attainment, am I? That belongs to you. It is yours. You gotta hold that door open. You. Seppo said he was not a teacher. But during the time that he was a Roshi, 87 people realized under him. And all he did was create a few situations. He had some pretty good monks. Anyway, this monk, after hearing Jensha with this thing, he goes to Uman and he says, you know, what's this all about? You know. And so Uman says, bow, please. And this monk is surprised by this. I don't think he should have been, but he was. He's got all, his whole mind is focused, all his thoughts are focused on having this question answered so he would understand, you know. But then he bows, and as he straightens up again in expectation of having the question answered, you know, instead of an answer, he gets his staff thrust in his face, you know, and he leaps back, you know. Well, says Uman, you're not blind. Now come closer, approach, huh? And the monk did as he was told, you know. Good, says Uman, so you're not deaf either. Well, understand what, you know. Ha, says Uman, you're not dumb either. And on hearing these words, this monk awoke as from a very deep sleep. You know, we will never know how deep asleep we are until we wake up. Only then will you have criterion. Yeah. See? What happened here? Huh? What is Uman pointing to? Again, you know, he points to you. If it's not a problem for you, if it is not your problem, leave it alone. And he says to the monk, "You've got eyes. Why waste your time thinking about blind men? You can lead a horse to water, but you sure can't make him drink. Why are you wasting your energy? If they are interested in enlightenment, they will do something about it, you know. But what are you doing about it, worrying about them? You're not blind. And you're a Roshi, Jinsha. Why are you wasting his time? See? Blind men will always be. Jesus said we will have the poor with us forever. You can think and worry about the deaf and the dumb and how to save them, but the one who can save you will not be around forever. Be concerned about your own state. Be concerned about your own ignorance. Others will do what they will do, and nothing that you do will stop them. The only one that you can really help is yourself. Why are you not helping yourself? Well, now, people, they're concerned about other people, and we should be. We help the lame and the halt and the needy. But when it comes to enlightenment, it's like this student who says to his teacher, "Well, I can listen to you, but what about all those who can't come to listen? What about them? I can read what you have written, but what about all those poor souls who can't read? Were you going to go out and teach how many people how to read? Well, fine, and go be a school teacher. Teach them how to read. And it's important, you know, that people read." You know, neither the Buddha nor the Christ nor the patriarchs, and on and on and on. None of them were able really to change this world. Only a few who were ready to hear. Worry about yourself. Wasn't it Paul Tillich who wrote the book, The Art of Selfishness? There is an area in which you should be selfish. You should protect this within you as if you were pregnant, you know, and going to give birth. After all, this is the shell, and the little chicken is going to come out somewhere, somehow, we hope. The they and the thems, you know, they're abstractions. You are not an abstraction. You are reality. See, and Uman, when he thrusts this, you imagine this fierce old man sitting there, you know, with the staff in the face of this, you know, and he jumps back, you know. All of him jumps back. See, it's a total action. And that's the point of meditation. All of you should be in meditation. Not all of you, but all of you, the total you, should be in meditation. You can go on and on and on and around and around and around inside the head. And some people do this for years on end, and they say to themselves all kinds of things, you know, I'm on my way, I'm on my way, I'm on my way, now I'm feeling this, and I'm on my way, and I'm on my way, you know. They're simply wasting time. That's not you. And the totality of you is not involved. You're not involved in existence, in life. You're only involved in the head. And it stays in the head. So you be like the Queen of Hearts, you know, in Alice in Wonderland. And she says, "Off with their heads." That's what Tokuzan said to his little priest. So we have this situation. He created this situation. It may be illogical, but seen from another point of view, it's very logical, and it's total. And it had the effect of shaking him out of his sleep. He didn't sit there and argue with him. He let it happen, huh? He awoke, and for the first time, everything became clear. And now this monk has a taste. And this disciple now can follow this taste. And now his search will be very different. You know, it's been mostly thinking up till now. It's a search for something unknown. And how difficult it is to put your life on the line for what you do not know. But now he's had a glimpse. He has tasted the ocean. Maybe only a teaspoon. Maybe only a sip out of a teacup. But the ocean tastes the same no matter where you go. Any ocean you go to, the taste is the same. See, and now he knows something different. It's a very small experience, maybe, waking up. It's a big experience when you do it. There's an open window. But even from the window, you can see the sky. Now he knows the questions are about the individual. The question is you. The problem is you. You, the individual. So see to yourself. Then you will have the clarity to see to others. Now. If I threw this and I hit you on the head, you would know reality. If I talk about it, that's abstraction. Hitting you on the head with a rock is a life fact. There's the difference, you see. Yeah. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.